Hi, this is Dave, and it's been 3 years since we launched Galactic Netcasts. And over that time, some shows have come and gone, but the one thing that stayed the same is our commitment to you, the best listeners on the internet. And that's why we're asking for your help. For as little as $1 a month, you can help us build the best sci-fi, science, and geek culture-based podcast network in the galaxy. And all you have to do is go to patreon.com/galacticnetcasts. That's Patreon, patreon.com/galacticnetcasts. Thank you for your support, and on with the show!
We interrupt this program to give you a bulletin just received from one of our naval units at sea. A large object traveling at supersonic speed is headed over the North Atlantic toward the east coast of the United States.
This earth of yours will be reduced to a burned out cinder.
This could be the beginning of the end for the human race. Human beings cower before the onslaught of these unearthly enemies.
It is Thursday, August 21st, 2014. Welcome to another Galactic Netcast. This is the Alien Invasion number 115. I'm going to go backwards this time. In Wausau, Wisconsin, Mr. Brad Ludwig and Anessa Moyens. How are you guys doing?
Doing all right.
Gawesome.
And I'm Dave Nelson from Ottawa, Ontario, Canada. That's kind of weird. I think that's the first time that we've switched it around like that. I'm never doing that again.
Got to roll with the changes there, Bob.
Yeah. We were having this weird, funny, offline conversation earlier, and autocorrect spelled Anessa's name, as it always does, Vanessa, and I just kept it that way because I thought, you know, we were talking about rolling with the changes. I'm like, I'm going to change Anessa's name to Vanessa.
And to that I say no.
Yeah. I know.
Homie, don't play that.
Yeah. Oh. Homie the Clown. Not many of those references anymore. That doesn't happen that often.
It really isn't.
I make them once in a while. It's okay.
All right. Welcome to the show where we talk about aliens invading the Earth from the beyond place, like space and other dimensions. Aliens are everywhere. They're in TV, film, video games, comic books, real books, and in real life, and we talk about them every week here on the show, and we divide the podcast into three sections: the news, the stories from the week relating to alien invasion, the craft corner, the spotlight of a certain kind of alien spacecraft, and our media picks for the week, what we've been reading, watching, listening to, playing, whatever. And if you want to watch us do the show live, you can do it. Just follow Galactic Netcasts on Twitter, Facebook, or Google+. And we will tell you personally, well, not personally, but information will come to those individual feeds as to when and where we're going to be going live with the show. That's how that works. Facebook, Google+, and Twitter. So if you guys are ready to rock, I am. The soundboard's back this week. Here we go.
In the news.
And doing something different as well, Anessa, you don't usually start the show with the news, but you're number one. You're number one in the batting order.
It's weird. I'm usually last because I either end up that way or get switched around that way. First story has to do with Mars and pictures from Mars. I've lost my train of thought. The latest pictures to come from Mars, people are often looking at them, not just people from NASA, but the general public, and it appears that they have managed to find in one of these images something that resembles a bone, potentially like a thigh bone, so that would be your femur, correct? Excuse me. So anyway, in the image, they've got what looks to be a whole bunch of dirt and sand and rock. And amongst these little pieces of rock, you've got like this image that looks like it is a bone sticking out of the dirt. Personally, whenever I first looked at the image, I thought of it as a rock. I didn't really see it as a bone. But yeah, I could see how some people might think it to be a bone if you were thinking of it as here on Earth. But I would think if there were bones, then we would have come across some of them already.
You know what it is? It's a rock on top of a long rock. It's like a roundish, smaller rock, like a triangle-looking rock on top of an oblong rock is what that is.
Yeah, I can see that. Like, it could be a couple of rocks, or it could be one rock that was just eroded away funny. So it's just really difficult to tell, but yeah, I kind of think they're rocks. If you go to, well, I found this story on cron.com, which is the Houston Chronicle's website. They've got it there along with the image, and then you can scroll to the next image, and you've got the item in question circled, or the rock in question circled. And I mean, that's not the first time that we've seen things in images before. Apparently, other sightings have included an iguana, a cat, a dinosaur, a dinosaur spine, two dinosaurs, a mysterious light, a toy boat, a half-human and half-goat face, and a rock that popped up from one image to the next when the rover wasn't on the move. So,
yeah,
we have a lot of imagination when we look at these images, and we're always looking for something, I think. But honestly, I think they're just rocks and lights playing tricks on us.
Yeah, this stuff is happening all the time. It seems like every week there's something new, either on Mars or the moon. Like, I think we had a story about something that looked like a shadow on the moon last week, right? That was last week's show?
Yes.
Last week? I don't remember. I don't even remember last week, to be honest with you.
This could be a feature. We could... What can we find?
What object do you see on this planet or moon surface?
Yeah, exactly.
So, what do you see? It's like one long Rorschach test. We can do psychoanalysis on people based on what they find in the images.
I want to see an image of the rock on Mars in rocks.
Well,
Dwayne Johnson,
like,
the rock.
There's a bunch of rocks. Look, there's the rock.
Yeah, but you can't smell what the rock is cooking in space.
No. You can't.
But you may be able to see the people's elbow.
It's true. So I saw this, speaking of the rock and totally not related in any way to what we're talking about, but I saw this tweet the other day that said something about, like, does anyone else think that the rock looks like Dwayne Johnson? People are awesome.
See, problem when you have a name like The Rock and then you decide to change it back to your normal name, a branding problem. That's a branding problem right there.
Well, I don't know if it's necessarily a branding problem, because The Rock was his wrestler name, but are you really going to use your wrestling name when you do acting gigs? I mean, you're not going to be like, oh, starring Triple H or whatever. So
I think it's been done before, but
I'm sure it has, but I think a lot of people that are going from wrestling into acting actually want to be taken seriously, and I think that's the first step in doing so is by using their name.
This might just be a case of a dumbass.
I kind of think it was someone that didn't bother looking them up. She could have easily done a Google search and found Dwayne, quote, The Rock Johnson, and she would have been like, oh, it's the same person.
Speaking of The Rock, or Dwayne Johnson, sorry, maybe we're going to talk about this on our other podcast, the Sci-Fi Geeks Club. Brad, did you bring up that story this week about Dwayne Johnson and his possible role in the DC cinematic universe?
I don't believe so.
Well, he would be playing either Shazam or Black Adam.
Yeah, yeah. Just wanted to bring that up since we were already talking about him. I would never just... out of the blue, bring up something completely different that we're not talking about. That never happens.
No, he's been teasing it for quite a bit, and I think he would make a better, I don't know.
Is it Black Adder? Is that what you said?
Black Adam.
Black Adam.
Adam and Eve Adam?
Oh, no, so not Black A-O-T-O or A-O-T-M.
A-T-O-M.
A-T-O-M, sorry.
Yeah.
No. Odom.
Black Ottoman Empire. Is that what that is?
Brilliant. Perfect.
Yeah, worst cool. Worst superhero ever.
He's a piece of furniture with a cape.
What was
Although
his...
It can't be any worse than the Wonder Twins.
Chairface Chippendale was a wonderful villain in The Tick. But that's another subject altogether.
What was Black Adam's deal? What was his? How did he get his powers? What was his powers? Where did he come from? What was his deal?
Seth Adam was an Egyptian from ancient times who was the first person that the great wizard Shazam bestowed his power upon. But Adam sort of turned evil and used his powers to conquer as opposed to save, which was the wizard's original purpose to them. And the wizard ended up trapping him and kind of leaving him entombed. And he was later uncovered. Depending at what point or which version of the DC universe, it was actually Billy Batson's parents that were archaeologists that found the item that was imbued with the wizard Shazam's power that Seth Adam had. And one of their assistants wore it, and he got the personality and everything of Seth Adam through the magic amulet, essentially, that granted him his powers again. So
it wasn't actually the real person from back then coming back to life. It's just the essence of him.
Yeah.
Okay. All right. And that, my friends, is our weekly comic book update from Brad Ludwig. Thank you, Brad.
There you go. Yep.
All right. So, rock that looks like a bone on Mars. Good stuff. Okay. Let's move on to the second. Thank you, Anessa. Did you have anything else that you wanted to mention?
No.
Okay. All right. Just checking. So, have you guys heard of Childhood's End, the book? Childhood's End.
No. I'm thinking. It sounds familiar, okay. But I don't think I've ever read it.
It may sound familiar from me posting the story this week on the Galactic Netcast social feeds.
I haven't really paid much attention to
okay. The
social feed.
Fine, I'll stop doing it then.
I'm sorry. I just I got a new app and things are a little different, so I don't always catch everything anymore.
Oh, okay. All right, I understand.
So I'm like, eh.
Okay, well,
yeah, I don't think I saw it.
I'll catch you up on the story. So sci-fi is at it again. Seems like every week we have a different story about a new show that they're adding to their roster. But Arthur C. Clarke had a story called Childhood's End, and sci-fi is developing it into a six-hour miniseries. This is according to Deadline.com. They have ordered the production into production of Childhood's End, and what's cool about this story is it's part alien invasion, because aliens come to Earth and kind of give humans everything that they want, turning it into a near utopian. So it's the opposite of dystopian, because, you know, we have too many dystopian stories these days. So it's going to turn into a utopian society. But then there's something sinister up with the alien overlords. They're not as nice as they seem to be. So that's pretty much it for the story. It's going into development, and one of the reasons people are very excited about this is there's some great people behind it. Writing the script is Matthew Graham, who has worked on both Life on Mars, and I'm not sure if it's the British version or the American version of Life on Mars, but I'm guessing it's the British version because he also worked on Doctor Who. But then at the same time, he's working for American television, so he could have done the American version of Life on Mars. I don't know. Anyways, it's Matthew Graham. He's writing it. And then it's being directed by Nick Horan, who also has done Doctor Who and one of the episodes of Sherlock, His Last Vow.
Oh.
Is that the one where...
That was a pretty good episode.
Is that the one where... what's his assistant's name?
Watson
gets married? Is that the one?
Yes.
Okay.
No. No. His final vow was the episode. No. The one where he gets married is. Ah, crap.
I thought that was his last
vow. No. His last vow is his. Basically, him coming forth with his. He made a promise to Mary and John. And he follows through with it. That was his final vow.
Okay.
And I'm not going to wreck what happens, but it's kind of a big deal.
Okay, so if you haven't seen Sherlock,
I'm trying to pull up seasons here. So, there we go, seasons. Okay, so it was The Empty Hearse was the first episode. The Sign of Three was the wedding episode, and His Last Vow is the third and final episode of that of season three.
And that was the last season, right? Season three.
Season three was the last season. They have been talking about a fourth season, and as both of the leads finish up their projects, like The Hobbit, and a couple of other side projects, they are going to do a season four. That has been confirmed.
Martin Freeman seems to like have his hand in everything these days. He's in the Hobbit movies, obviously, but he's also in Fargo, the TV series, which yes. I haven't seen, but I hear it's really, really good. I would love to see him doing an American accent, particularly a North Dakota / Minnesota accent from Fargo. Have either of you guys seen Fargo?
No.
No.
I have a hard time watching the movie.
I love the movie.
If they could get rid of the really horrible, the crappy accents that they have, because it's...
See, I know why it bothers you, Brad. It hits too close to home. It's too close.
It hits way too close to home. Hey there, you know, when I joke, and people who have listened to the episodes before, where I've gone, hey there, let's, you know, a couple trees side by each, that is that portion of Minnesota's accent, but it's not, they took it to the extreme.
Oh, yeah.
I understand that, you know, it's a movie and that's what they do, but after, it's like nails on a chalkboard to somebody who lives in this area, and it's just like, there comes a point where the brothers stop being funny. The Coen brothers, and it just like it becomes too much, and I can't. I've seen it once, and I'm not going to see it again.
Okay, all right.
That is actually a movie that I own.
Fair enough. Oh, I see a rift.
And there's no shame in that.
I see a rift. Just... You guys are starting to not agree on certain things.
Oh my God,
it's totally not the first time though.
I'm kidding.
If it makes them feel any better, Raising Arizona came with it, so I've got that one too.
Yeah, Raising Arizona is very funny.
All right, so let's. That was a weird turn. I guess that's what happens when you don't really have much information on the story. All I know is they're making The Childhood's End into a miniseries, which I'm very happy about. I'm really happy that Sci-Fi's decided to get back into the sci-fi business with all these potential series in production and back doing miniseries, which they've done a really good job in the past. Like, I remember that Wizard of Oz, The Tin Man, I think it was called? That was on Sci-Fi.
Yeah, Tin Man with...
Zooey Deschanel and... Oh, gosh. I can't remember the actor, but he was in Band of Brothers.
Oh.
Yeah, I don't know.
Oh, yeah. Okay. Good news.
Alan Cumming was in it.
Yeah.
Good Lord. Cast of thousands.
Yeah, for us Canadians, I'm sure we'll be able to see all of what Sci-Fi does on the Space Channel, because that's what usually happens. Everything that's
You're
on Sci-Fi ends up on. I don't live there. I live in Canada.
You were born in the States.
I know. All right, so let's move on to the final story and what you got for us there, Brad. Oh no, hang on one second. I know why that was so short. I had two stories this week because I thought, hey, this first one's kind of short.
Yes, you
did. And I saw this other thing and I wanted to bring it up. I think we've talked about this before, but it's actually happening now. They are basically relaunching the whole Alien Predator, Alien versus Predator Prometheus universe in comic book form. Dark Horse is doing this, and they just released it's kind of a trailer because they both show panels from the comic, but they also talk to the writers and creators of this whole thing. And it turns out they all live in like Portland or Seattle or someplace up in the northwest of the U.S. And they're very close together. It's kind of a neat community, and they're all working on this project, and they're basically taking all these stories and bridging them together. They're kind of redoing or adding on to the mythos of this whole thing. And according to the official synopsis of this trailer is about the Prometheus version of this comic book series. So they're doing Alien Predator, Alien versus Predator, and Prometheus, and this particular trailer is for the Prometheus story, and it basically picks up right after the journey to LV-223 in Prometheus, and kind of another team, I believe, going there or investigating their disappearance, that ship's disappearance. Spoiler alert.
What?
And they talk about different characters in this comic, and one of the characters is very much like a Ripley character, and they talk about that in the trailer. It's called Prometheus Fire and Stone Number 1. It comes out on September 10th, and of course we'll have the link in the show notes to check out the trailer to that comic. That's pretty exciting stuff. All right, now, Brad, it's your turn to talk about your story. Sorry.
Awesome sauce. So this story comes from the HuffPo. Space aliens are already here. I don't mean to scare anybody, but it's true. And NASA has them.
I knew it. They were holding out on us.
They were.
Those rats.
Well, here's the reality of the thing. So there was a project that they had launched, and it returned to Earth in 2006. The project was called Stardust, and its job was to orbit the Earth, and it was structured so that it would catch dust particles that were outside of the Earth's atmosphere, because we're being pummeled with rocks and all sorts of stuff all the time. But the question was, you know, what kind of subatomic particles or dust particles actually come to us? And if they come to us, where do they come from? And by looking at how these particles kind of got into the gel, and there was actually like this aerogel, it's incredible stuff. It's so incredibly light. I know what the gel is, and I've seen it. It was on do you remember the 80s show That's Incredible?
Of course, yes. With Fran Tarkenton was one of the hosts,
oh,
I believe.
Yes.
Yes.
Now, on this show, they actually had this aerogel. So it's been around for a long time, and it is incredibly light. And it's so light and airy that it can easily capture particles and slow them down, even if they're moving at high speeds. So they've got a team of what they call citizen scientists, so people that don't actually work for NASA but do have legitimate science credentials, and are helping to go through all of these sections of this satellite that they had launched, and using very, very accurate microscopes to go through and look at all these dust particles that they've collected, and kind of track at which angle they hit at. Why is that important? It's important because the possible origin of where these particles came from. And they found that a number of these particles, while they are newer, are 50 to 100 million years old. And we're basically getting samples of the galaxy, not just our solar system, but of the galaxy through this subatomic dust, these particles. So it is very possible that there is some kind of, you know, there might be microbial stuff that they haven't even gone through. It's going to take a lot of time to get through this, because this whole satellite was orbiting around the Earth and it was being pummeled. So they've probably got years of work. They've got 5% of it done at this point. This thing parachuted in 2006.
This really reminds me of that crowdsourcing, the other crowdsourcing program. I don't know if it was NASA or if it was SETI. I think it was SETI, where you could be an astronomer from home. This sounds like kind of the same thing.
Yep. So these citizen scientists called dusters, they have 30,000 of them.
Wow.
Working on this project. Let's see. They're working out of the Rhonda Stroud of the Naval Research Laboratory, like I said, noted that 5% of the – oh, I'm sorry. There was a foil that was with this too that encased the aerogel collectors, and they're going through the foil as well to see if dust grains have either penetrated or settled on that. So barely more than half of the aerogel collectors have been scanned and put at Stardust at home. So dusters have a lot more work to do. A critical aspect of this work is dedication. Was the dedication and hard work of citizen scientists who've worked on this. In fact, two of those dusters, Bruce Hudson from Midland, Ontario, Canada, there you go, Dave, and Naomi Wordsmith of Wexbury, Buckinghamshire, UK, were allowed to name the interstellar particles they found, Orion and Halebrook, respectively. They are listed with the 68 scientists co-authors of a science paper. Westfall himself discovered the third interstellar dust tract in the aerogels and called it Sorok, the Russian word for 40.
Oh, my God. I thought for a second that was Sorok from Star Trek.
No, Sorok, the Russian word for – and I'm probably butchering it. I apologize to any Russian listeners. which is the number of the track that it was found in. They've only got a small portion of this thing analyzed, but they're finding all sorts of dust and other particulates that are not from our solar system, and we may have actually picked up some microbial bits in that. Another note is kind of along with this, there's marine algae that's collecting on the outside of the International Space Station.
What? How the hell is that supposed to – how is that happening?
Yeah. I saw this on IO9, I think.
Well, when you think about it, there's some pretty hardy life down deep, 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 deep in the ocean. So it is possible that somehow some of that life was able to get in the atmosphere and survive in space. I don't know.
Well, the idea would be if the Earth was hit with a meteor or asteroid large enough to send debris out into space, it could have sent life out.
Oh, yeah.
One of the ideas that I've come across is that initially upon the formation of Earth, you have life that is starting to form, and we ended up getting bombarded with meteors. Or at least a larger meteor. And this sent a whole bunch of debris out into space, including some of the microorganisms that were already coming to be on Earth. And once things kind of heated up on Earth again, then essentially as some of the debris started getting pulled back in that was blown off back in from Earth's gravity, that it pulled back some of that bacteria, and so if they were able to survive in space and then make it down to Earth, then it would make sense that not all of it made it back down.
Yeah, I think just like people are realizing, humans are realizing that we're a lot more connected to the environment than we thought we were, I think they're also figuring out that Earth is a lot more connected to the rest of the galaxy than we thought.
And we've talked about panspermia before in a number of episodes, so it's not really a foreign concept. So here's the story. Found it on the Telegraph website. Sea plankton found living outside International Space Station. Russian cosmonauts claim to have discovered tiny marine creatures thriving in zero gravity on the outside of the International Space Station. Scientists on board the ISS are reporting to have discovered living organisms when taking samples from the windows. Head of the Russian ISS orbital mission, Vladimir Solovyev.
Man, you're just pissing off the Russians left and right, aren't you?
I'm horrible today. Said the result of the experiment are absolutely unique. They told the Russian news agency that the tiny marine life forms were not native to the launch site of Kazakhstan. Plankton in these stages of development could have been found on the surface of the oceans. This is not typical in the area of Kazakhstan. It means that there are some uplifting air currents which reach the station and settle on its surface. NASA is saying, well, that's the first we've heard of it. Russia hasn't shared any of that with us.
Oh, yeah.
This is from a NASA spokesperson, Dan Huat.
Oh, my God. You know what it is? It's not plankton. It's alien life from outer space. It just looks like plankton. And they're going to fool us. They're going to take it. They're going to bring it into the ISS. And then it's going to like start to morph and turn into like a bigger alien creature. And we're all going to be hosed.
I've seen Virus, although that was mechanical. Although he has confirmed that the Russian cosmonauts have been taking samples from the windows, he claimed that they were only looking for residues that could build up on the visually sensitive elements. The reports are unconfirmed, but microbes are known to live in hostile environments and able to survive in freezing temperatures and zero gravity. It is believed that this discovery was made during a routine spacewalk by Russian cosmonauts, and the surface of the ISS is heavily polluted due to engines from delivery spacecrafts and other factors. So, while in the SpaceX, the Dragon capsules have been launching stuff. So, you know, I guess while the Russians are going, hey, this has got to be coming from the oceans, we're still taking a cautious approach to it. But
yeah, interesting.
We talk a lot about how sensitive the balance is in life on Earth, and it's very interesting to take a story like this in contrast to that and know that despite everything that we do to this planet, you know, we're probably really not necessary in the grand scheme of things.
No.
And if the Earth were to shrug us off, it wouldn't care.
Yeah, no.
Life will go on with or without us.
Exactly. All right. Great stories, one and all. Thank you very much. Let's move on to our next feature. Oh, did we say something between this? Hang on. I always forget. Yeah, feedback. We would love it. Please let us know what you think of the stories that we're talking about, or anything that we discuss on the show, this episode or other episodes. GalacticNetcasts@gmail.com is the email address. GalacticNetcasts@gmail.com. Also, the voicemail number is 805-328-3966. 805-328-3966.
Please identify the craft you witnessed.
A black triangular three-dimensional shape. Huge, just flying, hovering in it.
Shaped like almost like between an egg and like a teardrop.
Two long cylinder objects flying over me.
We had a dome. I could see the occupants in it.
It appeared to be rotating, and it was almost circular to disc shape, and it hovered for maybe about 5 minutes.
Okay, this is our spotlight of a certain kind of alien craft in history, and sometimes, most times actually, we've done real, like, genuine UFOs that people have purported to have seen. But at least twice, I think this is the second time we've done fictional craft. And Anessa did the Base Stars from Battlestar Galactica. I'm going to do the Klingon D7 Battlecruiser. And there's a reason for this. And the reason's coming up in the picks. So stay tuned. That's what you call a tease. So, Klingon D7 Battlecruiser kind of served as the basic backbone of the Klingon fleet, basically during pre-original Star Trek series and during the original run of how many years were they supposed to be in space? Five-year mission.
Yes.
So it was. By 2267, they were prominently featured in the Klingon Imperial Fleet, where they posed a serious threat to the security of the Federation and Starfleet. They were so popular that even the Romulans were using the D7 Battlecruiser, although I think it was probably just, you can chalk that up to budgetary
constraints
on the original series, pretty much. The Romulan versions were slightly different. In fact, they had the Bird of Prey logo on kind of, I think, the underside of the wings or the nacelles on the Romulan version. The D7 class was almost predatory in its appearance, with widespread primary hull, long neck, and a head-like command pod. The bulk of the ship's overall mass was pretty much in the whole aft, the rear section. The bridge was located on the bulbous head, which I'm very uncomfortable saying, which was separated from the aft section by relatively thin neck, which I already mentioned, and then it kind of flared out to the back towards the warp nacelles. And the dimensions, pretty much the same size as the Federation Constitution-class starship, which was the original Enterprise. During the mid-23rd century, the D7 class posed a significant threat to the Federation. They were heavily armed, too. They had nacelle-mounted disruptor cannons, a forward-mounting phaser emitter, and a forward launcher capable of firing photon torpedoes, magnetic pulses, and disruptor blasts. So any Federation ship or any other ship coming up against the D7, you better watch your ass, pretty much. While the D7
cloaking.
Yeah, I was going to get to that eventually.
Sorry.
No, that's okay. They had the cloaking devices, of course. I believe it was the Romulans that had the cloaking device first. So I'm thinking that maybe there was some kind of trade involved. Hey, Klingons. I know that we've been enemies before, but we've got this common enemy, the Federation, and we have the cloaking device, but we need ships. So let's work out a trade. You know, give us the cloaking device, and we'll take some of your D7 battlecruisers. How about that? So I mentioned that they were about the same size, right? The Constitution class and the D7 battlecruiser, right? I mentioned that. Okay.
If you didn't, I had already mentioned it was in my head.
Okay. Of course, we could all hear what you're saying in your head, obviously.
Yeah. Obviously.
Under certain circumstances, this is all according to Memory Alpha, the definitive source for Star Trek information on the web. A single Constitution-class starship could, under certain circumstances, pretty much go head-to-head with the D7, but most of the time, the D7s were outgunning the Constitution-class starship or any starship in the Federation. By the late 24th century, these vessels were considered rather antiquated and were identified as being inferior in firepower, so it was very quickly the Federation turned the tide and one-upped the Klingons eventually by the late 24th century. Let's see. Some Klingon ships in the 23rd century were equipped with the... I've never heard of this, but it sounds interesting. The S2 Graph Unit, which was roughly equivalent to the warp drives in the Federation's Constitution-class starships. The warp drive of the D7 enables it to catch up with a ship traveling at warp 9, which I didn't even know they could do back in the original series. I thought they were limited to like warp 7 or 8. I don't remember them ever going to warp 9 in the original series. I thought that was Voyager. That was the first time they went to warp 9. Remember?
Well, they ended up, and I've got, what was it? FASA, which was a gaming company, put out a kind of a guide to ding
cookies are done.
They must be put out a guide to Next Generation, the new Enterprise and the Federation of the time that takes place in Next Generation, and they actually retooled the scale for warp. So warp one in the time of Next Generation is not the warp one of Kirk's day.
Okay.
So I think at some point after the 5 year, or after the point that we see of the 5 year mission, they were probably able to go a little bit fast. They were really pushing it if they got past. I remember warp 6 being something that they were just like, it's falling apart.
Yeah, it would shake the ship a lot.
Yeah. So I think probably at some point after the original 5 year mission that that happened.
Okay.
They were able to catch up.
All right. That makes sense. But if you remember the Klingons from the original series, you would recognize the D7 battlecruiser. And it showed up, I believe, on one episode of Star Trek Deep Space Nine, but that was it. I think they came upon an old D7 battlecruiser that was the crew was put to sleep for some reason, and I believe the Defiant had to go out and basically intercept it, and Worf was involved. He had to kind of talk him down. But I remember that being an episode, and that was the only time really outside of the original series that the D7 battlecruiser was shown in any other versions of Star Trek after the original series. So there you go. That is your craft corner. If you have a suggestion for a future craft corner craft, let us know, galacticnetcasts@gmail.com. So I was thinking you guys are going to have the same pick, and that will kind of segue. Your pick will segue into our next podcast. So let me go into my pick since it relates to the craft pick. You guys cool with that?
Absolutely.
All right, so the reason I brought up the D7 Battlecruiser for my craft corner was my pick is Star Trek Prelude to Axanar. It's a short film, about 20, 25 minutes long, released this week, part of a full movie that the producers are trying to fund, I believe, through Kickstarter. And they've already raised $100,000 of their $225,000, which was their goal. And they released The Prelude, which is part of the original movie, and it's really cool because it stars a whole bunch of, like, former Trek actors, and it looks fantastic. Did either of you get a chance to watch it? I know I posted it on the Galactic Netcast social feeds this week, and I know Anessa wasn't really paying attention, but Brad, did you see this link posted? Did you see it?
No.
Okay. All right. That's cool. That's cool.
My computer's doing crazy crap right now. So,
okay, all right.
It's going slow. There we go. Holy cow. Yeah, there we go. They're close to $400,000 out of their $100,000 goal.
Holy crap. Okay. So that must have... I think the reason that they released, and this is probably their plan all along, but I think the reason why they released the Prelude to Axanar, the short film, was to... kind of publicized and promote the fact that they're trying to raise this huge sum to get the full film made. So I lied. I said 100,000. I think they're at 200. What'd you say they were at?
They're at, right now, they're at $397,369.
Okay.
They've got 63 hours to go. And they were looking to raise a total of $650,000 for the full film.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, they were just looking to put together $100,000 for soundstage and set construction.
Okay.
But like you said, at the point in this story, it was at 225. Well, they've blown well past that.
Okay, cool. I hope they. I don't know if they'll hit their goal, but they're going to raise a lot of money in a very short time.
I think it looks like the way they're doing it is they're trying to raise bits where they can say, okay, you've given us this much. Here's what we've done with it. Take a look. Now we'd like to go further. Here's another Kickstarter.
Yeah. That's a really smart way of doing it because having one huge Kickstarter is really harder to get that goal, I believe, than to do a bunch of small ones because there'll be smaller goals which would add up to one huge amount, right?
Yeah.
And I really hope they make it because this Prelude to Axanar looks freaking awesome. Like, it looks just as good as anything J.J. Abrams is doing with the reboot of Star Trek. I mean, the special effects are fantastic. The actors they have. And it's, I didn't tell you this, it's like a documentary style. So it's basically telling the story of the war with the Klingons. That was never really shown in the original series. They talked about it all the time. I mean, Captain Kirk was always... There was a reason why he was pissed off at the Klingons, right? And that fed all the way through to, like, Star Trek III, where he was pissed off... No, actually, went all the way through Star Trek VI, because he had that bitterness for the Klingons, and that's where it comes from. It comes from the 4-year war with the Klingons, and that's what this movie's all about. It shows kind of, it breaks it down and documents it like any, like, if you were to see a documentary of World War II, it's basically the same thing, but it's documenting this 4-year war with the Klingons, and it's, God, you guys need to see it. It's really, 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 really good, and I really want to see it again really, 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 really bad. It's awesome. It's the best thing I saw this week. So it's Star Trek Prelude to Axanar. Tony Todd is in it. He played Worf's brother in Star Trek The Next Generation, Star Trek Deep Space Nine. He also played the adult Jake Sisko in that episode where Ben Sisko, Captain Sisko, is going through time, where he pops up every few years all the way through Jake's life. I don't know if you guys ever seen that episode, but it's one of the best episodes of Deep Space Nine. J.G. Hetzler, he was General Martok, a Klingon in Star Trek Deep Space Nine. He plays a human in this one. And also Gary Graham, who played the Vulcan, I forget his name, but he was like the head Vulcan in Star Trek Enterprise. Also Richard Hatch from Battlestar Galactica, and Kate Vernon, also from Battlestar Galactica, plays a captain in this Prelude to Axanar. So if you like great actors, great story with Star Trek, I know we're always wanting more original Star Trek. Well, there you go. Prelude to Axanar. It's online right now.
Uh-huh.
All right. So that's my pick relating to the Craft Corner. Now, Anessa and Brad's pick is related to our guest that we're going to have on our next podcast. If you haven't subscribed yet to the Sci-Fi Geeks Club, you really should, because we are going to have the author of The Martian, New York Times bestselling author, Andy Weir, on the Sci-Fi Geeks Club. So talk about The Martian without spoiling it, because I haven't finished reading it all the way through yet.
Not saying it was aliens, but it was aliens.
It's true.
Okay, so The Martian, written by Andy Weir, it is about a mission to Mars that ends up going wrong and strands one of the six crewmen on the planet Mars. Essentially, they were 6 days into the mission, and it was supposed to be a 30-day mission, I believe it was, and 6 days into the mission, they end up getting this really bad sandstorm, and they end up having to scrub the mission. The crew members are all trying to suit up and get out of their the hab or the habitat, basically a big pop-up tent that they all stay in. And yeah. As they are making their way in pairs to the ship, the communications satellite dishes end up coming apart, and this one particular crewman, Mark Watney, ends up getting hit by the debris. And he basically takes a tumble, and his suit is breached. And because everyone's suits have bio information on everyone's vitals, it reads pretty much that the atmosphere, like, he's lost oxygen, and he's pretty much gone. And so, unable to stay behind and look for him, they have to make the decision to leave. And he eventually comes to, because he gets knocked out, and he finds out afterwards that he's the only person on Mars.
And explain.
And now he has to try to figure out how to survive.
Explain real quick. Let's explain real quick that the blood actually clotted the suit and reestablished the atmosphere in his suit, right? Is that how it worked? Okay.
Yeah, that's how it worked. Because he ended up getting punctured by some of the debris, and so where there was a breach in his suit because he bled out a bit, and eventually the blood kind of coagulated and whatnot, then it kind of patched up his suit. And so he was able to survive. His suit's oxygen system was able to pump enough oxygen in and work, but it wasn't the greatest situation. So he was able to make his way back to the hab. And basically, we are reading, if you want to think about it, we're reading the guy's diary. While he is on the planet Mars, he is keeping a log, and he keeps the logs by days and days on Mars are called sols. And so he's basically unfiltered with his thoughts for the most part, because he's like, I'm on Mars, I'm the only person here, probably not going to make it, so I'm just going to say what I'm doing, why I'm doing it, and give my opinions on things. And so it's really interesting to see how he deals with the realization of being stranded on Mars, and how he decides, you know, he's just not going to give up. He's at least going to try to survive. He's going to put up a fight for his life. And so the things that he has to figure out how to do is how to, one, food is a big issue, because they only have a limited supply that they brought in. He needs oxygen, and he needs water, and he needs a way to filter out all of the CO2. And so he works with what he has. And if you think about it this way, he's like the MacGyver of Mars. The MacGyver of Mars, and he gets hit with a lot of Murphy's Laws, and it is just a really well done book. And even the story behind the book is also a really interesting story as well.
Yeah, because just like a lot of books and a lot of authors these days, he began self-publishing it, right? And
it didn't really start off that way. He basically, Andy Weir, did a blog, and he decided that, you know, he's really big into space and astronomy, and he's a software engineer, I think. And he had this idea one day that he was going to write a book about the possibility of getting stuck on Mars, but he wanted to do it in a way that would be plausible. So he used a lot of the same technology that we have now in the not-so-distant future, making the technology maybe a little better, since it's a little further down the line, but not far enough down the line where it's totally unbelievable. He didn't use any fictitious technologies like FTL drives or anything like that. And he basically posted a chapter on his blog once he finished it. And as people were reading these, you know, each chapter as they posted, a lot of these people were nerds. And and he would, you know, go and, if he didn't know the answer to something, he would actively go out and try to figure out the math. He figured out the math. He figured out the science. And when he posted these chapters, he would get feedback from people, be like, oh, hey, in this part, we noticed that you got this wrong. It would actually be this way. Like, this is how it would actually work. And so he would go back and he would correct that as he posted. And he got a lot of input for corrections and whatnot to the math and sciences behind his book. And eventually, he decided to take all of these chapters and put them in an EPUB and a MOBI format, so that way people could download them and read them on their e-readers. But then he ended up getting a lot of people that were not very computer literate or technically savvy, and they couldn't figure out how to get this MOBI file or EPUB file onto their e-reader. And so they asked him if he could put it on Amazon, and that's what he did. He put it on Amazon, and he sold it there for like a buck. And because Amazon wouldn't let him put it on there for free, so he's like, fine, a dollar. That's the price I'm going to charge. And so he charged a dollar, and eventually it led to the publisher picking it up and actually putting it in paper copy. But yeah, he initially just wrote this on his own. He didn't really have any intentions of it being a big thing. He was just writing it for fun.
What an amazing story.
So it didn't seem like he was actually trying to write a book to become published or self-published. He was just like, I've got this story in my head. I want to get it out. I want people to read it. And input's welcome. Corrections are welcome. Because he wanted this to be as scientifically accurate as he possibly could get.
And there's a lot of science in it, too. Like, you learn how things work through
reading
this.
Yeah, and he does a lot of the math. But he does it in such a way, and even talking about chemistry, and I think he said chemistry was like his weaker point out of all the subjects that he worked with. But he would actually sit down and work out all the math and try to figure out the chemistry and whatnot, so that way he could describe these concepts. But what I really enjoyed about the book was the fact that it didn't get too heavy. He wasn't posting a ton of formulas. And if it was something that was starting to get kind of lengthy, he'd be like, well, whatever, I'm just going to call this a whatever, you know, like a pirate Watts or something. I forget what it was. So, you know, he's talking about, like, coming up with his own units of measurement after a certain point and trying to not get too heavy in the mathematical or the physics or the chemistry. He just wants to explain it enough for the reader to think, oh, okay, I kind of get what he's doing here, and move on. He didn't get hung up on the science too much.
And it works with the character of Mark because Mark is very much a sarcastic, funny guy, a kind of guy that wouldn't go on and on about all the little details and the little math and science and stuff.
Right, because he's like, okay, you know, this is how I calculated how much food I've got. This is how I calculated this. But he's not going to list out, like, all the formulas that he used. And at some point, he's like, here's the number. And so that was really nice. And he did have his own, the character, Mark, puts in his own sense of humor into his posts. And it's just really funny to see. And it's also kind of amazing that a character like that, despite how much he's been through, doesn't really give up.
Mm-hmm.
As much as things go wrong and, you know, he only has so much resources to work with, but he definitely gets everything.
there's so many, like, laugh out loud moments too. Like, I laughed. Like, I don't usually, like, if I'm reading a book to myself, I don't usually actually, like, physically laugh. But there were so many, like, smart ass lines that his character said in that book that actually made me laugh out loud. And the best, the amazing part of this whole story about Andy Weir's story in this is it got purchased by a film studio. And it's being made into a movie starring Matt Damon and directed by Ridley Scott, which is...
Well, he was looking at it. And the movie's supposed to come out November 25th, I guess?
Yeah.
That's pretty cool.
Brad, where are you?
I'm having issues with my keyboard, and I accidentally unplugged my video camera, and that's why you're not seeing me
okay.
right now.
All right. So the listeners of the podcast could care less, but
yeah.
It was kind of funny how you were talking, and you were not at your desk.
Yeah, it's no, I'm definitely still here. It's just my camera has gone all wonky right now.
Okay. So, if you want to hear more about the story and if you want to hear from the author, here's what you do. Go to our website, galacticnetcast.com, and subscribe to the Sci-Fi Geeks Club, and you'll be able to actually hear us interact with the author of The Martian. Oh, you're back.
Welcome. I'm back.
Welcome back.
Yay. Yeah, and speaking of, like, lines that he throws in there and stuff, and this one really is not a spoiler at all. I did a couple of highlights along through the book, and one of them, he talks about the amount of daylight that he has, and he says, once the sun isn't visible, I'm in the dark. Phobos gives me some moonlight, but not enough to work with. Deimos is a little piece of crap that's no good to anyone. And that made me laugh, because I'm like, that's funny that he would, you know, compare Phobos and Deimos and be like, Deimos is crap.
Yeah.
It's a crap moon. It's no good.
People should not be intimidated by the subject matter at all. While the science was researched, while the science is sound,
it's not heavy.
Not shoved in your face. It's not, well, here's orbital mechanics and here's how clever I am. It's never presented like that because you never write a diary like that. Who the hell are you going to impress if you're writing that? I mean, he's pretty much resigned to the fact he's going to die.
Yeah. He wants people to know, like, what he went through and what his time on Mars was like. So.
And the other thing, too, with everything that he goes through, he's the only person to have been there. So anything that he writes down and documents while he's on Mars is completely uncharted territory.
Mm-hmm.
Because even at this point in time in the book, nobody stayed that long on Mars. It's been go there, set some stuff up, do some experiments, get out.
Yeah. And there's so many, like, firsts, like the first man to stay on another planet for so long. He actually becomes a settler. Like, he settles Mars. Like, he was there long enough to, I guess, technically, like, claim it for Mark or claim it for the U.S.
And it's funny how he deals with settling on Mars. He's like, I'm the first, you know, Martian farmer.
I'm the first this. I'm going to name this rock after me, sort of thing. And he's like, I can do that. I'm the only person here.
Yeah.
I think I've earned that right.
Yeah, it's a great book. It's a fun read. It's informational. It's you'll like it. I can guarantee you you'll like it. Anessa, you finished it. I'm pretty close to finishing it, so.
I finished it first.
Ah. Oh.
Yeah, he finished it in the car while driving to and from Michigan.
Okay.
So.
Okay, you win, Brad. You win.
That's right. Bam. Because it was totally a contest.
All right. So,
well, I bought it before you.
That's true.
Okay, shut up. Shut up. Quit it. We got to wrap this baby up because we're going to talk to Andy here in a few minutes.
We're going to talk to Andy himself.
Yeah. So those are our picks. We will have the links in the show notes that you can check out both our picks, which were Star Trek Prelude to Axanar, the short film, and The Martian. All right, go to galacticnetcast.com and check us out. Get all the links. Subscribe to the Sci-Fi Film School there. Subscribe to this podcast if you haven't done that yet. We've got links to our social accounts, how to contact us, the works. If you're on Stitcher, if you're a Stitcher user, we're on Stitcher as well. Or we're on iTunes. Search for The Alien Invasion or just search for Galactic Netcast and subscribe to us that way. All right, that's going to do it for this Galactic Netcast, The Alien Invasion number 115. Thanks for joining us. Final thoughts, Brad, go first.
I'm going to be working on a etching project, so I will finally get those mugs done that I promised over a year ago.
Hey, you know, it's not how fast you do it, it's how well they turn out. So that's what I'm looking forward to.
And finally, we'll have our much talked about Galactic Netcast mugs, and I'll be able to send one to Paul Swickard as well.
Yeah, we'll have to have a Galactic Netcast like party, and we'll all use our mugs at the same time. That'll be
there
awesome.
There we go.
Yeah. All right, Anessa, what's your final thought?
I actually don't have a final thought.
That's the best final thought ever.
Oh.
All right, guys, that's it. We'll talk to you guys next time.
Sounds good. Bye.
Bye.
Leave your hailing frequencies open and scanners on full, because another Galactic Netcast will be approaching your coordinates soon. For more information, go to galacticnetcasts.com.